Good evening, Coastsiders, and welcome to The Great Debate. Tonight's event features the three candidates for Half Moon Bay City Council District 4. My name is Ruben Truthmaker, and I am co-host of KHMB's live call-in talk radio show, Coastal Windage, The Talk of the Coast. Tonight, I will be moderating this historic event brought to you live on KHMB, your community radio station. That's right, this event is live. No outtakes, no cuts, no safety net. The three candidates with us tonight are competing for the District 4 seat on the Half Moon Bay City Council. They are Bill Balson, Debbie Ruddock, and David Oblovy. Welcome, candidates.
Good evening.
Good evening to you. Thank you for coming. Each of you has the opportunity now to make a 5-minute opening statement to kind of introduce yourself to the listeners and potential voters. Okay, let's start with Debbie.
Good evening. So what do I bring to the table as a District 4 candidate? It's a no-brainer. I'm the current mayor and council member already doing the job. The Daily Journal endorsed me saying that I'm doing the work and making progress doing it, and you should vote for Debbie Ruddock. You can go to www.deborahruddock.com/compliments to see just some of the progress I and the council have made to stabilize the city's finances, bring state, federal, and county tax dollars back to the city for critical traffic and other public works projects, help strengthen our nonprofits, and look after our most vulnerable residents. Look at how the city managed the COVID pandemic and how we've emerged stronger and more resilient and in good shape financially. I've got the public service background. I am the only candidate who has worked in coastal zone management and understands the regulatory and scientific context. I've worked as a grants manager, developing complex projects for grant funding worth millions of dollars. I served my state agency as our legislative analyst and liaison for more than a decade with the legislature, the State Department of Finance, and the governor's office. I've got working relationships with our own and many other state legislators and state regulatory agency personnel. I sit in our regional transportation planning agency in our new countywide flood and sea level rise district and have developed relationships with other city council members and our board of supervisors. I have been an alternate coastal commissioner and have built relationships there. For experience, know-how, and relationships, vote for Debbie Ruddock.
All right. Thank you, Debbie. Nicely done. Okay, let's see. Let's go with Bill. Bill Balson, let's hear from you.
Hi, my name is Bill Balson, and I'm running for city council. First thing I'd like you to know about me is I love Half Moon Bay. My wife and I spent 10 years of vacations traveling up and down both coasts of the United States, and this is the town we picked it. We both love it. Half Moon Bay has some problems. Some of them are big problems, like housing, but we can solve these problems working together. You can find a lot of details about me on my website at www.billbalson2022.com and in Spanish at www.es.billbalson2022.com. Both are identical, just in different languages. So I'd like to spend my time in this introduction talking about the big issues that Half Moon Bay has. First, we need a well-flowing traffic system, including reliable public transportation. And this is the top issue on the survey I conducted of Half Moon Bay voters. It's also the top issue by 75% to 80% on the city's own survey they conducted this past summer. And yet, the mayor said, no way, we're not going to widen the roads. Get over it. And she said it twice in a public meeting. That's not the attitude that city council members should take toward the public, and it's not how you solve problems. Traffic congestion can be reduced with well-designed roads. We had 403 accidents on Route 92 over the last 3 years. That's unacceptable to me. We had people die. And the reason is that it's not a well-designed road. It was designed around 1963. It's got narrow, windy roads and no shoulders. Simply widening the shoulders would allow people to pull off the roads if they have a flat tire, for example, and that would reduce traffic congestion. Second, we need a sewer system that protects the environment and recycles water. There have been plans for this for 15 years. The most recent was an actual bid in 2016 that was rejected in part because the city decided to sue its business partners at SAM. They shouldn't have done that, wasted millions of dollars on litigation, and they're still appealing it. The SAM water recycling, when it's eventually built, should be for irrigation, not for drinking water. 84% of a survey I conducted said that. In 2004, another 84% of the population in a referendum said that SAM should do recycled water quickly. We need a compassionate and cost-effective homeless solution. The encampments should be designed to discourage camping, for example. It's been about a 58% increase in the homeless over the last 3 to 4 years, and that's because it's gold-plated. My last estimate, totaling up all the costs spent by the county, donators, the Half Moon Bay, and so forth, is about $350 per night per homeless. That's just way too much. That's why it's too attractive. Third, we need a climate-friendly policy that's also family-friendly. Half Moon Bay should seek the best reduction per dollar. The ordinance that the city passed is just going to encourage people to try to avoid making changes, and yet water heaters, for most people that have a 10-year or older water heater, those can be replaced right away and reductions in CO2 emissions. We need a commitment to approve affordable housing that's compliant with the land use plan, and we need a helping hand to our local businesses and workers who sustain our economy. I'd also like, a little bit later during the evening, to talk about my 5-point plan for getting Half Moon Bay back on track. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Okay. And that leaves us with David.
Thank you. So I'm going to modify this a little bit on the fly. So I'll get to my own qualifications and successes here in a second, but I think that it's important to have context. We have three eminently, at least on paper, qualified candidates with a very disparate set of qualifications, and I think it's worth, just as I talked about, or I'm going to talk about the things that I have done and hopefully I'm proud of, I want to also do a reality check and show some of the reasons that I'm running. So with that end, Debbie, you're first on the block. Debbie's a fantastic person who I admire, and she's done some amazing things on the co-side. But the reality is, the reason I'm running is because some of the things that have happened in the last few years that are unfortunate, I think. The council under Debbie has overseen wasteful spending, like the $1 million that was thrown down the drain on the recently canceled Main Street Bridge project, and the $1.5 million that went away on the SAM suit that started in 2017 and which we lost in February. Debbie also has an unfortunate history of deference to the sheriff, including supporting Bolanos in his previous election, despite his history of visiting brothels, trafficking in minor children, and she's also failed to provide the minimally required oversight that the city is required by law to provide. These are things that are critically important in my mind. It was difficult for me when Debbie abandoned our Latinx population in 2017, when 300 people showed up at a city council meeting to request that she work, she was the mayor at the time, work towards making Half Moon Bay a sanctuary city, and she refused to do so, saying that it was virtue signaling. Somewhat ironically, Ron DeSantis was caught saying it was virtue signaling, I don't know, a month ago or whatever, the same policy. So there are other things, shortcomings, and what I consider to be less than great outcomes for Half Moon Bay that will probably come up during the debate. But I'll leave those there. other than to say that I think Debbie has done a really good job in many ways, but she lacks a vision for our future. And that was what initially inspired me to run, because there are some things that I want to make changes to. So with that thought, I'll skip ahead. I'm a data-driven guy who believes that we are who we protect. And in 2013, I led the community effort to save the Main Street Bridge by nominating it to the National Register of Historic Places and authoring the Main Street Bridge Preservation Act, which you, the voters, approved by a 68% margin. As already mentioned, I had to get the city to halt another $14.5 million attempt this past year to destroy the bridge, unfortunately sacrificing $1 million in preliminary engineering that shouldn't have been spent. In 2015, my initiative forced the city to get an interest-free loan from the county to fund our portion of the library instead of issuing bonds. This saved all of us $5.3 million in interest payments that we will never have to make. And last year, I authored what would become the Jimenez-Rarbach Report initiative, in which council members Jimenez and Rarbach sought to implement basic changes to how Half Moon Bay approaches policing our residents with a focus on maximizing effectiveness and minimizing harm to everyone in our community. My vision is one of a more fiscally responsible city focused on building sustainability into everything we do, whether it is the city's finances or environmental issues, housing, discretionary spending, or safe and readily accessible public trails for pedestrians, e-bikes, and bikes. To do this, I propose to place into effect a requirement that for any discretionary spending, there be an 18% contribution to our rainy day reserves to mitigate against our risk, given that we are completely dependent on tourism occupancy tax for our existence. I propose specific policy changes to rethink, reimagine, and then redo our approach to public safety from one mired in the past to one focused on our needs today for everyone in our community. I propose to increase our partnerships with non-governmental organizations like Abundant Grace, ALAS, and CoSide on Bikes, all of whom are leveraging their partnerships with the city, doing exemplary and selfless work caring for our at-risk populations. I propose to work on removing barriers to infill housing by doing things like working with CCWD to rethink the water permitting process, hopefully lowering the immense barrier to entry for anyone seeking to build a home on an infill lot. And finally, I propose to immediately terminate our appeal of the SAM suit and to call an open meeting with the directors of all three partner agencies so that we can forge new relationships not mired in the dogmas of the stormy past, but that are instead founded on the principle that we are all in this together. Wow, I timed that well.
All right. Well, nice timing, David. And thank you also to Debbie and Bill for those introductions. Okay. Now we get into the meaty section of the evening. This debate is being presented as a public service to the voters of District 4 and the city of Half Moon Bay. It is a chance for these candidates to give voters deeper insight into their positions, their thought processes, and their public demeanor. We will hear not only how they answer questions, but how they ask questions and how they handle themselves in situations of disagreement. For each discussion topic that is going to be coming up, I will introduce the topic by presenting a general question to a specific candidate. This will begin the discussion. From there, candidates are free to discuss the issue as though they are sitting around the kitchen table. As you discuss the topics, candidates, please consider what factors are at play with regard to this issue. What is your position? What do you propose? If you are quoting statistics and other data points, please be prepared to cite the source of this information. Personal attacks, poor language, and lack of decorum should not be part of this discussion. As moderator, I am not going to fact check, and I'm not going to rescue anybody. If you start digging a hole, you're going to be digging for a while. But I may ask for clarification if something seems particularly unclear. Candidates are free to respectfully ask and answer questions from each other and encouraged to do so, including challenging statements made by another candidate or asking for sources. But please, do not interrupt or talk over someone when they are speaking. Please try to be efficient with your questions and your answers. We ask the candidates to remember that they represent not only themselves, but also Half Moon Bay and the Coast Side. Okay, and with that, are we ready to rumble, candidates? Yes, okay, everybody's giving me the nod. Okay, we're going to start first topic. We'll start with, and these topics are presented in random, not in any kind of ranked order of importance in any way. So the first topic, we'll start with Bill. The general topic is homelessness. Bill, the 2022 San Mateo County one-day homeless county survey found a 20% increase from 2019 in the number of people experiencing unsheltered homelessness in the city of Half Moon Bay. Do you think that homelessness is a problem in Half Moon Bay? And if so, how do you propose to address the issue?
Well, I do think it's a problem in Half Moon Bay, and it's a problem not because we lack empathy. We have an abundance of empathy toward the homeless. Our problem is that we don't make the locations where the homeless build encampments unattractive for camping. And so when you provide people with basically free services, you need to make the locations unattractive for new homeless to set up camp. Otherwise, they'll come back. And I've studied Health and Human Service reports on this topic, and they all, in the final chapter, they talk about redesigning the locations, whether it's under bridges and similar locations, to make them unattractive. Some cases they can make large stoneworks or block pathways and things like that. The second thing I would address is the overspending. I totaled up all the various categories of spending, and it looks to me like we're spending about $350 per night per homeless person, and that does not include health services from Medi-Cal or the VA, for example, and it doesn't include policing either. We can reduce that. You can go to a Motel 6 for $100 in the local area.
What would you propose to make the... So there are two primary places in Half Moon Bay that our homeless population resides in. One is under the Highway 1 overpass over Pelosi Dos Creek, and the other one is just to the east of that on... private property. What would you propose to do to make the locations less attractive?
Well, in one area that's not too distant from here, they hauled in very large boulders. And the boulders themselves occupied the places where people would naturally set up either a tent or a makeshift shack. And those can be effective. Other places, there are other kinds of designs that might work.
So you're proposing boulders where they are now?
I'm not making a specific proposal, but that's an alternative that could be considered.
Okay, so let me follow up. Neither of those pieces of property belong to Half Moon Bay. We don't have jurisdiction over either one as it relates to the homeless population.
No, but every 2 years, in sync with the election cycle, we seem to have Caltrans come and clean up, quote-unquote, the homeless encampments. And what they're doing is just taking away the debris that the encampments leave when folks are rousted out of the encampments. The part that's not done is to make those locations unfavorable for camping.
I understand, but what I don't understand is how you're going to make property that belongs to someone else unfavorable.
Well, the other location I was talking about is also owned by Caltrans. Most of these locations are Caltrans properties, and so ultimately they have to agree. The same conversation is going on in Santa Clara County, as you probably have seen in the papers.
So I'd like a chance to address it, since the city is actually working on the problem, and I'm a council member, a sitting council member who's actually working on the problem. Listening to both of you on some of these topics reminds me of a quote by H.L. Mencken. He said, "For every complex problem, there is an answer that is clear, simple, and wrong." So let me tell you what we're doing. One of the first things we did was start funding the clean team, working with Abundant Grace. So we pay the homeless to clean up the beaches and the adjacent neighborhoods. And each year we've expanded the scope of their work, so they're now helping out in downtown, after the weekend. So, we're giving them honest work and paying them, $25 an hour to do it. And we've given a loan of $300,000 to Abundant Grace to start the Workforce Development Center on Kelly Avenue, where people can come have meals, shower, and be connected to work. That's another thing. We've developed working relationships with all of the nonprofits in the county who have case management responsibility for each of the homeless in our community. Many of them are very stable people. A good chunk of them actually come from the coast side. You know, there, but for the grace of God, go I. We worked with the county to establish Coast House, which is transitional housing in a motel very close to downtown, that's close to the Abundant Grace Workforce Center, that's close to the county clinic, and is working quite well. It's mostly people over the age of 60. They're spending time there 4 to 6 months, and they're moving on to housing. So homelessness is a nationwide problem. It has many complex causes, people losing their homes, mental illness. One of the other things we did was seed the CARES program, which is Alternative Mental Health Crisis Response, and it works with any member of the community, but also the homeless. They do welfare checks. So we've actually accomplished quite a bit in terms of addressing the different pieces of homelessness. Now, we cleaned up behind Safeway. People moved. They moved to private property at the corner of Main Street and Highway 92, and the property owner's not cooperating in terms of addressing the nuisance. Some of the homeless have moved east of Main Street behind the post office. We're in the process of developing a plan to remove that encampment. And then in all these areas where we're moving encampments, we're going to be fencing and probably doing some restoration work on the creek. Right. And we're working with the county, who now has a zero tolerance for homeless program. And step by step, we're going to tie people to services and housing. And we're not going to solve the problem of homelessness, but we're going to keep it manageable. And, you know, we're also taking the position that, you know, we're not going to criminalize the homeless, and we're not going to allow them to be abused. So I think the city is on the right track.
So if I could jump in here, in the main, I agree with Debbie 100%, and that's why I was querying you, Bill, about your proposal to bar the homeless from access to property that we don't own. One of the shining areas that I think the city has been led by our now city manager, Matthew Chittister, in caring for our at-risk populations. If you go back to what I said during my opening statement, I look to redirect more funding to third-party NGOs like ALAS, like Abundant Grace, because these are programs that are paying very real dividends in terms of not only minimizing the impact of the homeless on our environmental circumstance, but also on the community. And the last thing is they're giving people who are homeless, who do not want to be homeless, a potential outlet to work their way or otherwise progress out of that circumstance. So you'll probably hear me gripe about a lot of the stuff that the city's done, but this is not one of those areas. And I think, unfortunately, the general public doesn't understand the problem and the level of complexity that is attached to it. They simply see homeless people with bikes, for example, and there's a whole underlying narrative that goes with that that's not seen. And that was the other thing that I would add to this problem, is I would do better messaging, or I would try to get the city to do a better job messaging both what the city is doing and also what the impact is on the homeless population and what the real impact of the homeless population on the people who live in the city is. So
let me make a couple of points.
I just want to respond on one thing. So on your website, you mentioned one of your recommendations is forming a subcommittee of the city council. And we actually have that already, and that is Vice Mayor Penrose and Council Member Joaquin Jimenez. So they, you know, meet with staff, you know, to keep up to date, monitor what's going on, and you can always talk to them.
Bill, I think you had something you wanted to add.
Yeah, you didn't hear me criticize any of those programs, but I will now. I've looked at Life Moves 990. They have 7 people with salaries between $150K and $300,000. For this kind of a nonprofit organization, that seems very, very rich, and it's part of what accounts for $350 per homeless person per night put up at Coast House.
What's your source for that?
I got their 990, I got the city's data, and I got the county's data.
Okay, but is that for services being provided to the city? Because LifeMoves does all kinds of stuff that has nothing to do with the city.
It's a mixture. We can go through the details here.
Is it their base salaries, or is it their base salaries plus other compensation?
Plus all their compensation. Secondly, recently, there are two fairly major crime activities that have been traced back to the encampments, not historical times. These are current. One was bicycles. A large number of bicycles were stolen and traced back to the encampments. And the other was patio heaters. Now, you could sort of see why those are high-value parts that would be pilfered by people that need to generate some cash. But we have to get rid of the encampments.
What's your source for knowing that bicycles were being stolen by homeless people?
The Sheriff's Department.
The Sheriff's Department in what form?
The Sheriff's Department.
Do you have
Are you talking about the police log?
Yes. Yeah, it was complaints made to the Sheriff's Department.
And put in the newspaper. The newspaper police log.
Yeah.
Because the sheriff actually publishes, they don't publish, they make it available to the city manager quarterly, the run stats.
Yeah, yeah. Look, David, if you're trying to deny that, that crime is on the increase, maybe petty crime, theft here and there, and it's a lot of it's because of the homeless factor, you're barking up the wrong tree, because that is happening.
I have the sheriff's reports. Crime is not on the increase. It's on the decrease.
I think we're going to be discussing crime. And I want to do that in a more robust way. So if we could,
robust
if we're going to do crime, let's move on to crime.
All right. Crime is not the next topic, but okay. We have about, I think, about a minute left on this. So, of course, I'm going to drop a bomb right here with a minute left and, you know, watch you guys scramble on that. Okay. So what do each of you feel about the idea of an overnight homeless shelter? That's something that is not in place right now. Would that address some of the homeless encampments in terms of a place for somebody to be for that night, to get them off the street or out of the creek that night, as opposed to what the Coast House is, which is longer term?
It can help for the willing, but not for the unwilling. And part of the problem with the homeless is you have a component that are either on drugs or have another issue that they're not willing to go to treatment for, and that usually is a requirement for any kind of a shelter.
So there's robust shelter capacity over the hill and very close. You know, it's all distributed all up and down the peninsula. But Bill's right. They have to, you know, want to go to the shelter. Now, we tried bad weather shelter several years ago. In Pacifica, the churches rotate shelter for the homeless during inclement weather. We tried to do it here in Half Moon Bay, and the churches weren't interested, mainly because they also offer things like child care services, and they don't have a lot of space to do that. So that was unfortunate. One thing that is being proposed for the Coastside is a safe parking program, because many of the homeless live in RVs or vans or, you know, their vehicles, but they don't have a safe and routine place to park. So a proposal has been developed by some locals, and it's actually being submitted for a grant to the county to find a piece of land and to allow safe parking at night and to match it with services and showers and things like that. And then you would avoid the case of the homeless man at Smithfield, you know, being assaulted.
Right.
So the key thing is, you know, a safe place to park. So that makes sense to a lot of people, and a lot of the homeless would be interested in that and have expressed interest in that.
Okay, well, thank you all for that first discussion topic. We're off to a great start. If you're just tuning in, this is The Great Debate, featuring the candidates for District 4 Half Moon Bay City Council, and that would be Debbie Ruddock, David Oblovy, and Bill Balson. And right now we're going to take a short break for these messages.
San Mateo County offers choices to its voters. Registered voters receive a ballot in the mail. Voters can return ballots to any ballot drop box through the mail or at a vote center. You can vote at any of our accessible vote centers, featuring a touchscreen ballot marking system and offering multilingual assistance. For more information, please visit smcvote.org.
In Half Moon Bay, there are three secured ballot box locations. Inside of the Half Moon Bay Library, Senior Co-Siders, and New Leaf Community Market. You can also return ballots through the mail, or you can vote at any accessible vote center featuring touch screens and paper ballot. There are two co-side vote centers in Half Moon Bay at the Emergency Operations Center, 537 Kelly Avenue, and in Moss Beach at the Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints, 435 California Avenue. For more information, visit smcvote.org.
The city of Half Moon Bay says vote and have dinner on us. You are invited to join friends, neighbors, and other voters for a special Elections Night Out event. Drop off your completed ballot or register to vote and have dinner courtesy of the city of Half Moon Bay. The complimentary dinner will take place on October 27th, 5 to 8 p.m. at the Half Moon Bay Library, 620 Korea Street. Learn more about the vote-by-mail process and how county vote centers work by talking to San Mateo County Election staff. City staff will also be on hand to talk about current local projects. Half Moon Bay's Elections Night Out. Vote and have dinner courtesy of the city of Half Moon Bay. More information by visiting hmbcity.com.
The city of Half Moon Bay and Republic Services announces a Earth Day recycling event November the 5th, 9 to noon, at Smithfield on Wavecrest Road. Free services for the residents of Half Moon Bay, rain or shine. There will be a compost giveaway. Bring your own buckets, shovels, and gloves. Document shredding. Limit 3 banker boxes per household. No contact e-waste recycling. This includes such items as televisions, monitors, printers, computers, cables, cell phones, DVD players, and more. For more information, visit hmbcity.com/recyclingday. Or call Republic Services at 592-2411. The Earth Day Recycling Event, November 5th, 9 to noon, at Smithfield on Wavecrest Road.
And we're back. I'm Reuben Truthmaker. I'm the moderator for tonight's big event, The Great Debate, featuring the three candidates for Half Moon Bay City Council District 4. Debbie Ruddock, David Oblovy, and Bill Balson. Okay, we've been discussing some major topics, and we're going to get into another one right now, and that is transportation and mobility. And we'll start with you, Debbie, on this one. Traffic is usually one of the first things that residents complain about when they move to the coastside, and it's always at the top of people's minds. Lots of little things have been tried, like adjusting the bus routes, reconfiguring the timing of traffic lights, adding bike lanes, and widening short stretches of Highway 1. But the problem persists. Is there anything substantial that can really be done about traffic on the coastside? And if so, what are your ideas for improving mobility on the coastside? We'll start with Debbie.
How long do I got?
Well, we have 10 minutes for this topic.
Okay. So two of the most feasible and relatively quick things we can do, focusing on 92 now, to improve congestion and safety is, one, work with our new District 3 County Supervisor to implement a nighttime-only schedule for quarry trucks. And two, work with our new District 3 Supervisor to better mitigate pumpkin farm traffic. We have a little Disneyland out there and have not been very successful after many attempts to get the county interested in a solution. But we're going to have new blood in there, and I say we jump on that opportunity. As for widening 92, the county, which has jurisdiction over most of the highway, proposed 20 years ago to widen the road to 4 lanes from 280 to the summit and straighten the road from the city limit to the uphill passing lanes. The estimated cost then was $200 million for widening and $100 million for straightening, plus millions in environmental mitigation. The county shelved the plan. We know that in today's dollars, the cost would be enormous to do that particular project. Maybe there is a smaller scope plan that would provide benefit, but right-of-way would still have to be acquired. If this is something Half Moon Bay residents really want to revisit, we can do so, but we're going to have to discuss the trade-offs because county, state, and federal transportation dollars are not unlimited. And these are the same sources of funding that also help pay for SR1 improvements projects, bike lanes and pedestrian projects, and roundabouts. I believe the subject is worthy of an in-depth conversation for the community, but the consequences impact not just vehicular traffic safety and convenience, but also community character and pedestrian safety. In addition to cost considerations, there's plenty of research showing that we can't pave our way, meaning add new travel lanes out of traffic congestion. Research consistently shows that adding capacity doesn't alleviate congestion for long because it actually increases vehicle miles traveled. And you can Google an article, Increasing Highway Capacity Unlikely to Relieve Traffic Congestion, from the National Center for Sustainable Transportation at UC Davis. Wide roads also make it more challenging for pedestrians and cyclists to get around. Would you rather walk around Pacifica or Half Moon Bay? State Department of Transportation policy has shifted, no longer prioritizing congestion reduction, but instead prioritizing reducing vehicle miles traveled and reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. The Department of Transportation also has a fix-it-first policy rather than building new road capacity. These policies shape the eligibility of projects for state and county transportation grant funding. Would widening SR-92 compete well in this policy environment? I think that's a crapshoot. Given this context, the city is focused on a comprehensive approach that includes multiple components, including but not limited to timely road and street maintenance, operational improvements at intersections, including, you know, potentially roundabouts, safety enhancements, investing in bike lanes and trails, development of programs for carpooling, etc., working with the school district on scheduling, potentially supporting a bus option.
Well, let me jump in right now.
I want to just finish real quick. So
you already gave me 44 different things that I can criticize.
Well, I want to go on
because
we have a solution that might deal very effectively with Highway 92, and that's an aerial tram. And I'm part of a team of community residents right now who have worked with engineers and SamTrans to get ourselves to a position where we could look at a feasibility study. It not only would reduce congestion, like, say, in the weekends, but it would allow you to have emergency evacuation or to bring in emergency supplies. And you can piggyback utilities like phone service on top of these cables and these towers. So it's something worth looking at. SamTrans is about to launch a very promising pilot project in the spring that would be a public-private partnership to operate an on-demand shuttle service, kind of like Lyft, but it would be, you know, public-private project. And we're looking forward to working with SamTrans on that.
I'm going to stop you and point to Bill and let him get a word in here because I'm curious to what he has to say.
Okay.
Well, Debbie, I want to compliment you because you must have gone through a few focus groups to get from get over it, we ain't widening the roads, to let's discuss the trade-offs. That's a big jump for you, and I appreciate that.
I don't need mansplaining, Bill.
Oh,
thanks.
Come on. No name-calling. The theory of induced demand simply doesn't apply in Half Moon Bay because we have limits to growth. We have Measure D. And so you could put a six-lane road there, and it would not induce growth here because of our regulatory limits.
No, but our problem is weekend traffic. It has nothing to do with growth. Our problem is the 250,000 people that want to come here on hot summer days from Modesto.
That's right, David.
Well, that may be true, but people are dying on Route 92. They're dying, and they're dying because it's a badly designed 1963 road.
So what are you going to do about it?
Widen the shoulders so people can pull off. Department of Transportation studies show that nationwide, and it's supported by our own fatality statistics and injury statistics, about 40% of congestion comes from what they call one event issues, like people having a flat tire. If you have a flat tire on 92, you got nowhere to go. You sit there while you change your tire. The traffic builds up behind you down the hill. Somebody runs into somebody, and it's a worse accident. Maybe there's a fatality. There's just no place for people to go. There's no place for emergency vehicles.
So how are you going to change that?
Personally, I would start looking at alternatives to add shoulders that are properly designed.
But Highway 92 doesn't belong to us, Bill.
No,
we can't add anything to Highway 92.
It would have to be a collaborative analysis between Half Moon Bay staff and Caltrans. There's no question. But Caltrans can bring forth alternatives, but Half Moon Bay has to support them. And if we have the attitude we have now with our city council, and I'm the only candidate that is willing to tackle traffic congestion in Half Moon Bay.
That's not
we
true.
Have,
it's
is
not true, Bill.
It is true. And you've said it. We ain't going to widen the road.
You can see our plan online.
I think for listeners out there who can't see this, I'm actually between them, so I'm kind of stuck in the middle. So I'm going to assert myself now and actually answer the question as asked. Debbie already addressed the fact that widening the highway was looked at
22 years ago.
Yeah, quite a while ago. And I think one of the things you have to understand when you come to Half Moon Bay, and it's why I spent the better part of 3 to 4 years intensively working to learn about the history of this place before I decided to run, you can't ignore the past when you're going to make changes in Half Moon Bay. Highway 92, to add a shoulder, would basically require doubling the width of the road. It is probably close to a $1 billion project when all said and done.
I agree.
And we don't have the clout to make that happen. What we do have the clout to do potentially is work with the new supervisor coming in to, for example, get a protected turn lane at Repetto's so that we can actually have safe, I drive over the hill every Saturday and Sunday bringing my kids to hockey. And every Saturday, early Saturday afternoon, mid afternoon, I'm coming back and I'm getting stuck in pumpkin traffic, or I'm going Kings Mountain Road in Tinnitus, because that's the only way to get back in less than an hour and a half. So I think we need to look at manageable solutions that are achievable. Widening Highway 2 is not achievable, nor is it going to happen in our lifetimes, even if we were to try. Working with a county on projects that can get approval, like a protected turn lane with a light at Repetto's, could cure inbound and outbound traffic bottlenecking during high traffic holiday weekends in a way that would actually make sense. The nighttime only quarry restriction or quarry and dump restriction, I think, would also be huge. But that's daytime traffic during the week as a general rule, and that's not the problem. The last thing I want to say on this, I'm going to take a sip of water first. The last thing I want to say on this is the reason we all moved here is because this is heaven on earth. And the problem with living in heaven is everybody wants to go there. And you can't engineer your way out of it. Santa Cruz is also a form of heaven on earth. They have a 4-lane divided highway bringing traffic to them. And what's that highway like as it enters all the way over the hill and as it enters Santa Cruz on a hot weekend? Exactly the same as Highway 92. The way to solve this is not by adding more lanes. There are studies, as Debbie quoted, and just common sense tells us that that's not going to accomplish anything.
The accident data actually go the other way, David. Most of the accidents occurred during weekday rush hours, both morning and nighttime.
I'd like to point out that there's also problems with the intersection with Skyline Boulevard, right? There's been a lot of T-boning. Which, you know, maybe we ought to look at a roundabout there. I don't know if the landscape would allow that, but something's got to be done at that intersection.
People go
sure.
through it too quickly, both directions.
Well, or they slam on their brakes to let somebody on, then you have a rear ender. So that's definitely a point that needs looking at.
All right. Another excellent discussion about transportation and mobility. Let's move on to our next topic. Sewer Authority Mid-Coastside, also known as SAM. Mm-hmm. Sewer Authority Mid-Coastside, or SAM, is a multi-agency partnership between the City of Half Moon Bay, the Granada Community Services District, and the Montero Water and Sanitary District. It provides wastewater treatment services and contract collection maintenance services for the coastside from Half Moon Bay to Montero. Disagreement over the details and responsibilities of this agreement have led to operating issues and a lawsuit filed against SAM by the City of Half Moon Bay. In February, the city lost its lawsuit against SAM, and the Half Moon Bay City Council voted to appeal the verdict. Given the initial verdict and the approximately $1.5 million in attorney's costs already spent as a result of this lawsuit, do you think the city should continue to pursue its suit? And regardless of the outcome of that legal action, how do you propose to repair relations with the partner agencies? We'll start with David on this one.
Hooray. I was going to actually take the role of that since I haven't gotten to go first. I just said gotten, by the way. Good thing no one can see me. Okay, let's start with 2017 when I wrote in the review that suing our partner agencies in SAM was the dumbest thing we've done in Half Moon Bay in quite a while. I predicted that we were going to lose $1.5 million, and I predicted that we were going to lose. And the reason for that was a plain reading of the operating agreement between the three agencies made it pretty clear that Half Moon Bay was skating. So this is one of the areas where I ding Debbie pretty hard, and she knows that, because I think it was a very, very bad choice. I think when we lost, we should have cut our losses. And here's why. Because of the three partner agencies being at war with each other, essentially, actual maintenance, actual progress, actual recycled water has been on hold since essentially 2017. We need to take a different approach. The other thing I want to add to this is Bill has been saying a lot about SAM budgets, and I've tried to make sense of it all, and I haven't been able to. But the reality is SAM is fine financially in terms of how we're accounting for it, and I have the numbers in front of me here if we want to dig into them. But we're not necessarily building – our infrastructure in SAM is aging. It's in some cases, what, 50, 70, 46, 50 – I can't do math, 45 years old, 50 years old. And the cost to replace that infrastructure is going up steeply every year. So bottom line is we're going to see sewer rates increasing no matter what we do. And we need to be working together with our partner agencies to move forward in a productive way, which is not what's happening right now. I would, as I don't think I mentioned it in my opening, but my first goal, I think I did, my first goal would be to get the partner agencies, we would dismiss the lawsuit and move on, and to sit down in an open meeting with all the partner agencies and all the members, not just the appointed two members from each agency, to build a coalition to move forward and to put the past behind us, because we can't afford to the biggest thing facing SAM that I think is an issue is we can't afford to carry the baggage of the last, well, 10, 20, however many years into the future, or we're going to destroy our local economy between sewer rates and, as Bill mentioned previously, environmental issues. So I'll stop there and toss it to whoever wants it next.
Yeah, I think I should respond. Next. First of all, our brief has already been submitted to the appeals court, and the other agencies have to respond no later than November 8th. So I think trying to kill the appeal at that point would be utterly irresponsible, and I'm going to tell you why. So the issue goes back to the 90s. The city attorney at the time, with Myers Nave, issued a public opinion that the Joint Powers Agreement does not require the city to share the cost of the intertie pipeline system. In fact, we did not pay for it the first time. Another previous city attorney similarly opined. The JPA states clearly that an agency not benefiting from a project does not have to participate. In fact, only Montera and El Granada, like I said, paid for the construction of the pipeline the first time. In addition, Prop 218, which governs the setting of property-related fees like water and sewer, requires, among other things, that no fee or charge may be imposed for a service unless that service is actually used by or immediately available to the owner of the property in question. As the intertie is a gravity system uphill and up the coast from Half Moon Bay, it terminates at the treatment plant and serves no part of the city's service area. The city, under Prop 218, must not use its sewer fee revenue to subsidize the cost of improvements that are used by Montera and Granada alone.
City so starting residents are served by GCSD. So how? So
we're only talking about Half Moon Bay ratepayers here, okay? This Prop 218 affects ratepayers.
Let her finish your defense.
So starting in 2017, with the large and costly spills that we had in the intertie, a new city council, city staff, city attorney, and a specialist attorney reviewed the JPA and the previous opinions and came to the same conclusion. We are facing an estimated cost of up to $25 million in system repairs over the next several years, and possibly a like number for the sewer treatment plant itself. Taking our fiduciary responsibility seriously, the city asked the Superior Court to review the JPA and clarify roles and responsibilities. We agree that litigation has cost more than anticipated, largely as a result of discovery and a mediation process that failed while the case awaited hearing in Superior Court. We lost the first round, but we decided to appeal because of what we see as errors in the court's ruling, and also address issues that weren't resolved. We expect the cost to be a fraction of the cost incurred because most of the work was done for the Superior Court. The city's brief has been submitted to the appeals court, like I mentioned. So RETA failed mediation. Our three agencies did reach agreement on a settlement terms under the auspices of a judge after about 18 months of mediation. When the final document went out for signature, Montera and Granada balked. This is already public knowledge. I'd like to point out that there's also an equity issue here. Half Moon Bay Sewer Collection System serves Moon Ridge and low-income and senior housing. Montera and Granada, on the other hand, are higher-income communities than Half Moon Bay and spend a great deal of effort fighting off affordable housing proposals and have voted time and time again to constrain infrastructure to limit growth. So we believe it's unfair and unjust for economically disadvantaged ratepayers to subsidize Montera and Granada's sewer rates. My understanding is that the law does not allow the city to offer lifeline rates. However, a separate combined sewer district could do so.
Yeah, most of that is just BS. You know, the
not very constructive, Bill.
Well, here's what is constructive. Judge Rudy saw through every one of those arguments, and he saw through it because for 34 years, one board after another at one council after another at Half Moon Bay approved intertie capital expenditures each year from 1983 to 2016. So you can't, under our American system of contract law, follow a particular interpretation of a contract for 34 years and then wake up one day and say, oh, that's not fair.
Bill, you once said publicly you were not a lawyer or an accountant, and I think that that's true. So
I'm just reading
here.
You Judge Rudy's ruling, who said that
we
the
think
city's
it's wrong.
Interpretation is unreasonable. Now, that's about as far off base as
we'll see what three judges say.
Yes. Well, the other thing I'd like to point out is that one of the things that's been terribly broken here is trust. There is no trust remaining between the JPA partners, and the first order of business is to build trust back. This is not the way to do it.
Yeah,
so
if you had
a neighbor whose water was leaking and running off onto your property, and you tried to work with them and ask for their help in stopping the problem, you would only take it so far before you ended up suing, right?
Making my point about why I think on some issues you're too close to them. We have lost trust. All the partner agencies and, frankly, the people of Half Moon Bay have lost trust in you on this issue.
I think you're wrong about that.
Perhaps I am, but the reality is you can have all the reasons you want that it was in the service of a good cause and that we're right, but the reality is a plain reading of the contract going back to the very beginning. It's a dead issue, but again, we
the
need trust.
The plain reading of the contract says you don't have to pay for what you don't use.
Well,
it says it very black and white.
The judge found against the city very convincingly, and yes, I've read the entire ruling.
I don't think
ruling.
It was convincing.
Well,
yeah.
Obviously, given that you appealed it. The reality is what we're talking about here, set aside the suit completely for the moment. The trust between the agencies is non-existent. I went to their meetings three years ago, I think, and I was just stunned that people didn't bring knives and guns. I mean, it was ridiculous. And I'm pointing at Half Moon Bay, I'm pointing at UCSD, and I'm pointing at MWSD.
Well, the real solution is consolidation of the districts into one special district.
Okay, that's a separate argument completely for a venue that needs way more time than we have here. But I think that I think Bill and I are actually in agreement here that the city has done a very, very poor job on this issue and has cost us a bunch of money, and it's just going to keep bleeding cash on this issue until we get rid of it.
The bulk of the money is already spent.
Yeah, no, if their appeal brief is due on November 8th, then it's going to take 2-3 months after that, so it's fine letting it ride because there's nothing left. But once that's done, it's done.
And every day that passes, 1 million gallons or more of water that could be used for irrigation is being sent out into the ocean.
It's not because of the lawsuit.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not. So what's going on at SAM is the fact that the treatment plant is at the end of its useful life. We have an electrical system that has to be moved. And potentially we have to move other parts of the plant because of atmospheric river flooding and pulses of strong storm surge coming up the estuary and down the Kehoe Channel. So the plant has issues. Currently, we're going to be needing to use the one of the aeration basins that potentially we were going to use for the recycled water. We're going to have to use it as a backup to treat BOD. So that's not really, you know, an option anymore. So it's going to, the plant right now is heavily constrained by its own infrastructure demands, and that's going to impact where we could locate recycling facilities. That's not to say it can't be done there or nearby. And we're going to be looking at that. But right now, there's a lot of...
The plant needs to be on a fast track to get water recycling in place. And if that needs to be combined with a complete redesign of the whole plant, then so be it. Let's do that. But let's get the funding in place and a project design and get it moving.
Well, right now, the board has prioritized improvements to the sewer treatment plant. You know, those have to be done first. Those are at risk. We're at risk of losing the electrical system and a bunch of other stuff, too. And if you look at our agendas every week, we're spending a lot of money to replace infrastructure. So that's priority number one. Now, the priority for the water district is recycled water, and they're working on that. And eventually we're going to have to come together and do it together, both the member agencies of SAM.
We're running out of time here, and I want to ask you a question. So, you know, one of the perceptions in the community and certainly with our partner agencies, right, is that Half Moon Bay thinks we're special or Half Moon Bay is in it for themselves. I have a hard time arguing against that, right? So I have an attitude that, yes, I live in Half Moon Bay, and if I am elected, I'm going to be representing the people of Half Moon Bay. And I know you do, and you take it seriously. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we've kind of flipped the bird at the rest of the coastside. That's the perception. And if you think that isn't the perception, come on.
That's a historic perception going back 50, 60 years.
And we've further aggravated that perception by suing the other two agencies. And so
sometimes the city has to sue, and this is legitimate.
Again, setting aside the lawsuit, we have to find a way to work with our partner agencies, and the level of trust there with the people who have been involved to this point in time is almost zero. And I get everything you're saying technically. I get your argument. I don't agree with a lot of it. But the reality is the legitimacy of the current council and historical people is pretty much shot at this point, and I don't think it can be recovered.
Okay, thank you for that. That was, I think, we all felt that it's a pretty hot topic on the coast side, and I really appreciate everybody's comments on that. Okay, and it's time for another break. This is The Great Debate with the three candidates for Half Moon Bay City Council District 4. We'll be right back after this. All right, Coastsiders, welcome back to The Great Debate. I'm Reuben Truthmaker, your moderator for tonight, and this is a live two-hour radio event featuring the three candidates for Half Moon Bay City Council District 4. This is an open-ended discussion-type format where we have a variety of discussion topics, and the three candidates are allowed to discuss it amongst themselves to allow voters to really get a sense of the candidates' positions and how they will react in a public setting. Okay, our next topic, our next broad topic is democracy. Across the nation, it seems that many people are worried about the state of the American democracy. Campaign financing and tactics, lack of local participation, restrictive voter laws, redistricting, term limits, government transparency, and concerns about the very legitimacy of the elections are just some of the concerns. Candidates, do you believe in the legitimacy of this election, and will you accept the results even if you lose? What, if any, concerns do you have about the elements of democracy, such as the ones I have just mentioned, here in Half Moon Bay and San Mateo County? Let's try to keep this conversation at a local level. How is this going to affect people in San Mateo County, in District 4, in the Half Moon Bay city limits? And let's start with Debbie.
That's kind of a big question.
It is a big question. I mean, so I guess I'll try to, like, fine-point it a little
for you. Could you, like, break it into pieces?
Yeah. Let's talk about the legitimacy of elections. Mm-hmm. Whatever the results of this election, will you accept those results as legitimate? And do you believe in the legitimacy of the election process in Half Moon Bay and San Mateo County?
I do. I think the county runs a really good election. It has done so for years. It prioritizes it, actually. And in Half Moon Bay, we've worked hard to make the election process more robust. We have election night out ahead of election night where people can come learn about the candidates and the issues. They can vote. They can have a meal. They can meet department heads and candidates. We actually passed an ordinance that cut campaign limits basically in half from what they were, so that individual contributions were capped at $250 and organizations capped at $500. Previously, you know, it was like $500 and $1,000. So we've tried to make it a more of a competitive race so that more people can feel comfortable running. So, you know, I believe in the democratic process. My family was very political. We walked precincts when I was growing up and, you know, went to the fish fry with the assembly member. So the democratic system is very important to me, you know, personally, and I believe so to the city. We're also hosting Jackie Speer on the 29th next Saturday for her last town hall on the Coast Side called Democracy, What's Not to Like? And we're going to hear her stories about, you know, working in a democratic process and celebrating that. So, yes, I will honor the results. I have no reason to question them.
And, but if you felt it was a close vote, you wouldn't feel shy about calling for re-election.
Absolutely. That's part of the democratic process.
That's part of the code, right?
Yes. And I've gone over to the county after election night and observed, you know, vote counting and challenges and things like that. And that's a very important part of the process.
If it was close, would you accuse, I don't know, entities of fraud?
No. You know, if it were real, depends on how close it was. You know, if it was, say, 20 votes, you know, I might challenge it, ask for...
No, but my question was, would you assume or accuse people or anyone of fraud?
Absolutely not. I've you know, lived here 30 years, been through a lot of campaigns myself, seen a lot,
so
and I've never seen any
evidence.
So
the reason I asked that question, I already knew this, but Bill, I got this in my mailbox today. On November 11th, 2020, you wrote, some of the allegations of voter fraud are simple to prove. For example, in Nevada, about 8,000 dead people are known to have had their ballots cast this year. This is simple to look up in public databases. It's clearly fraud since the intent to vote such a ballot is self-evident. Usually these types of fraud occur but are unlikely to change an election. They are, in fact, intensive to prove in large numbers. You also apparently wrote... I'm not sure the date, but the first red flag comes in from, this was during the same period, I'm guessing, the first red flag comes from mail-in ballot dates. The voter records of the counties show that 96,600 mail-in ballots were voted, yet the county records show they were never received back. So during the post-election period in 2020, you were spreading voter fraud myths that have been disproven.
I was quoting newspaper articles at the time. This was in November
and
December.
Bill, these are your words. There's no quote. You can read them right there.
November and December of 2020, when the challenges that were presented in court.
Bill, I'm sorry. You say right here, some of the allegations of voter fraud are simple to prove. Well, if you're going to say things that aren't true, I'm going to interrupt you.
No.
You say some of the
allegations. Because those were quotes. They were quotes out of judicial ruling or filing.
Bill, this isn't a quote. It's your words.
Okay. So I was quoting from judicial filings.
Some of the allegations of voter fraud are simple to prove is a statement.
Okay. Hold on.
Finished their ruling.
There we go.
In late December, I stopped making comments. And you will notice all of those quotes are from December of 2020 and earlier. That is part of our process. And that is part of what was going on in December. And I have made it quite clear to you and Debbie that I acknowledge Joe Biden as the lawfully elected president. Now, there's no question about that. In my view, to go back to the original question, democracy rests on the twin pillars of equal voting rights access and free, open debate in an open public forum. And if you take either of those away, the legitimacy of elections will be questioned by one side or the other.
Okay, that is another heated topic that we've got there, right? Okay, so but what I'm hearing and what I heard from Debbie was that she would accept whatever the results are. I heard that from Bill as well. David?
Quite obviously.
Okay, so all three of you believe in the legitimacy of the elections here in San Mateo County and Half Moon Bay and will accept the results as they come in.
Yep.
Okay, that's good to know. That is, Debbie rightly identified, that is a very large topic which had a lot of things, and I apologize for trying to pour the kitchen sink in there because each of you submitted some ideas for topics.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to pile them all into one category.
And I think it's really important. And we can talk about some of the other pieces that you mentioned, too. So,
well, let's move on to some other topics. If we have some time, we can double back on that one. Because those are, you know, I know that there's questions about transparency, about voter laws and things like that. But let's move on to the next topic. Let's talk about financial sustainability. Mm-hmm. Local government never seems to have enough money. And the city of Half Moon Bay is no exception. Do you feel that Half Moon Bay is budgeted annually in a transparent and fiscally sustainable way, including how the city manages its different types of funds, conducts long-term financial planning, and accounts for and promotes economic development? What are your ideas for addressing the city's financial stability and economic prosperity going forward? Let's start with Bill on this one.
Well, the short answer is no. You can look at the lead-off chart in the city's own budget package, and it shows that expenditures are going to exceed revenues by $1 to $2 million every year for the next 5 years. And their defense on that is, well, we have money saved up in reserves. And most of those reserves were saved up for a purpose. For example, over $10 million has been drained out of the sewer capital fund and used for operating fund purposes. That would be a nice down payment on whatever upgrade to SAM.
What's your source? What's your source for that claim?
For what?
That $10 million has been...
The budget. There's no question about it.
Okay, I have it right here. Can you show me?
I'm not going to do that right now. Debbie, tell me. Do you deny that $10 million was moved from the capital fund into the operating fund?
I think you need to be more specific. I didn't see what you were talking about.
On March 16th.
Okay, well,
$10 million plus was taken out of the
budget. The city answered that for you, Bill. No, this is something I need to answer first. So the city has already answered you on this, and you're not accepting
it. They said $8 million got put back. And that the other $2 million went into the operating.
So what happened was we switched to an IT system that allowed the various departments to communicate and see the same amount of data, right? It's an enterprise computer system. And it's very complicated to implement. And at the time it was implemented, there were four journal entries. One was a correct one, but then three repeated that same one. So the appropriate entry was $2 million, not $10 million. It was corrected right away. The auditor saw it and said that, you know, the way we handled it was okay. So, you know, we got a clean audit.
Wait, can I run with this, please?
Go.
So what do you do when you think your kid or your bank account got drained? You call the bank and you say, hey, bank, how much money do I have? So the journal entries, which you're referencing, were a mistake. No argument. But what you would have done if you had known how government works is you would have looked at the financial reports for the 2 years in question, the year before and the year after.
And if you go back 3 years, the capital fund had $14 million. Now it's got about three.
It's got $13,683,000 and it's got $11,937,000 at the end of 2020.
And now it's got about three.
In the time period, no, it doesn't.
Yeah, it does.
In the time period, well, show me your numbers. I've got mine here. We can dissect them.
Do you have the 2022 budget?
I didn't need it. You're claiming that they took the money out in 2020. You're claiming that they took the money in March of 2020. That's
back.
Between June 30th.
They took $2 million out that year. They took $2 million out the next year.
Yeah, they took $2 million. They moved $2 million from capital to operating. That happens when you have to fix stuff because you pay it out of the operating fund. This isn't...
That's how you pay staff
capital,
that's assigned to the
mostly
division.
For capital expenses.
But go back to your claim a minute ago. I'll read it again for you here. On March 16th, 2020, $10 million was withdrawn from the sewer capital fund.
And
no, it wasn't.
It
isn't.
Yeah, it was.
Okay, where'd it go? because it's here in June 30th, 2020, and it's here in June 30th, 2019.
David's
where'd
right.
it go?
Went into the city's cash pool.
There is no such thing as a cash pool.
Yeah, there is. That's
it doesn't exist.
It. No, that's not true. That's what they call
You're
it.
You're referring to the general fund. That's not a cash pool. It's what they generally pay
it's
most of the ongoing
expenses.
Operating expenses
yeah.
from. It did not go in there.
The ledger is called the cash pool. Those are the names.
The cash
used.
Pool.
On the ledger that was printed
that's
out.
That's part of the, you know, the administrative
to me
accounting.
By the city clerk.
But it ends up in the general fund.
Let me back up a step here as a person that can't even balance his own checkbook. But because I think what voters are hearing in this discussion, there's a disagreement here about this, but the larger question is, and I'm sure that Debbie's answer is yes, she's part of the system, but do the three of you, each individually, feel that the city's finances are managed properly for the current fiscal period
yeah.
and for future
So I'm
going to
jump in, Chris, because we're on yeah. a limited time frame.
But
so
I still want to be able to respond.
Of course,
city
always. So yep. first of all, yes, the city's finances are well managed. If you look at the CAFR, the financial report at the end of the year, it shows that they're well managed. But there are two huge buts here. The first one is Bill says that we're going to be $2 million short a year, $1 million short a year over the next 5 years. That's a forecast. You change that by either taking in more revenue or decreasing your expenses.
Right.
It has nothing to do. We're not overspending anything. They have capital improvements projects on the books. They have other projects on the books. They have expenses in overhead for employees, for all kinds of stuff that you can reduce by stopping doing. Mm-hmm. So the second thing is the sustainability. Now, Debbie, I need another sip of water. Sorry, give me one second. Debbie will say, accurately, that the city maintains reserves in accordance with GASM or
we
whomever.
Exceed the recommendation.
You exceed, yes, you exceed the recommendation. However, it's not enough. Okay? We live in a single source of income existence. And so what happens if the Ritz falls into the ocean, which was sort of what we thought was going to happen when COVID hit. We got lucky because people still kept coming to the coast. So our TOT revenues did not drop as precipitously as we thought. And we had more money than we thought. But the reality is we need to be salting more money than the average town, which is what that standard is based on. We need to be salting more money away, which is why I want to move towards having discretionary spending require, I'm using the number 18% for right now, we would need to look at what the right number would be, of contribution to, I'm calling it the rainy day fund so people understand, but basically the reserves, so that we can build up a 10 or 15 or $20 million reserve over the course of a period of years.
Tell me what you think discretionary funding is, and then give me some examples.
Discretionary spending?
Yeah.
Anything that's not required to operate the city. So surveys would be an example.
$30,000
grant writing,
service.
Grant writing, mm-hmm. grant rate. No, I'm not saying it's a lot, but the point is over time it adds up. Okay. The discretionary spending we spent on the Main Street Bridge project that got killed at the beginning of the year. Okay?
I'm going to address that tonight too.
Okay, good. But that's $1 million that didn't need to be spent and it was actually lost for nothing. There are plenty of ways. It's basically like taxing discretionary spending. Okay. Maybe the number is 5%, maybe the number is 15%. But we're not building for the future. Our expenditures almost perfectly track revenues every single year. They just go up and down. When I first got involved, it was $10 million a year, $9 million a year in expenditures and revenues, general fund revenues, obviously. So the thing that I would bring that's different than what Debbie would pursue and that I'm pretty sure is different than what Bill would pursue is building a bigger safety net for the community for that time, which is going to happen, whether it's an earthquake or the Ritz does fall into the ocean or take your pick, so that we have 2 to 3 years of operating capital, given that we would reduce operating costs and expenses, that we would have that on the table to keep us afloat while we figure out what the hell we're going to do going forward to fund our city. So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, so having a big rainy day fund is good, you know, but we are a government and, you know, people pay taxes and they deserve, you know, services and you know, well-maintained infrastructure. So it's kind of a balance, right? You don't want to not address the problems that you have in terms of maintenance and
sure,
you know,
I'm not suggesting that
right.
anything be left on the ground.
Yeah, so we have a pretty good rainy day fund right now, but say we're facing a recession. Yeah, we're going to have a bigger rainy day fund. And I think we need to do longer-term forecasting. I would agree with that. But like some have mentioned that we should be putting away an amount that would cover pretty much, you know, all of our infrastructure out 20 or 30 years.
Oh, God, no.
And then you get into the problems.
No.
Are you going to ask a person who's 70 years old to pay into a kitty for somebody who's going to be using sewer 30 years down the road?
Sorry, I'm not trying to talk over you, but we're talking about revenues that come from tourists, basically. So we're not talking about increasing property taxes. No one's paying any more than they're paying now.
Well, and we addressed the economic downturn during COVID. You know, we had to make some painful cuts. We did it, and then,
then
people started going back to the hotels, and, you know, we recovered.
But there is a role for building a different kind of reserves than you're talking about, and that is for future capital spending so that you can avoid debt financing. And there are in the financial manager's guidance that you were quoting for volatility measures for reserves. There is another one in there that talks about policies for capital spending. You know, engineers used to call it sinking funds.
And we do have sinking funds, like for vehicles, for instance.
For vehicles.
Yeah. And other things, too.
And I think everybody looking at the SAM, the sewer account capital fund, as a sinking fund for a future large expense. And that's largely gone.
Part of the problems we've had is that the agencies historically have insisted on, you know, getting back. Rather than putting money in the reserves at the end of the year, they want that money back to go back to the individual agencies for their own purposes.
But we're nowhere near the GAN limit.
So, you know, we're going to be developing a policy where we keep that money and roll it over, but we have to assign it to something. So
there's another aspect I'd like to turn to, and that's the idea of having a 30-year plan. Mm-hmm.
Bill... Right at the bell. Bill, why don't you just finish that thought there?
Well, yeah. So I'm president of an HOA. The state requires us to have a 30-year plan where we identify every single asset, what its lifetime is, what its replacement cost, its maintenance cost, and we have to disclose that to our membership. There's no reason the city can't do that. There's a question as to what percent of funding. I agree that calls to fund it 100% are not reasonable, but funds to call it funded at 0% are equally.
Well, I would agree with you, and I've asked the city staff to bring back an item on a future agenda to establish a citizen oversight group, you know, 3-4 people to look at investment policies, reserve policies, infrastructure spending, budget allocation, and have that be a platform for further outreach to the public as well. You know, we've been talking about, do we widen Highway 92? Do we build bike lanes? You know, we have to understand what the trade-offs are for certain sort of budget decisions. I don't think that we've had as robust a discussion as we need with the public to say this or that. You know, the public wants a new pool.
Well, let's also be frank that the vast majority of funding, just like for Carter Park, for large-scale infrastructure projects, is going to come from the state, the county, the feds, or other sources. We don't have the revenue to...
That's why we're paying, you know, people to help us with grants and people to help pay us for
totally
lobbyists.
I totally understand that.
And back to the discretionary spending thing, I mean, we've spent money on a couple of surveys, one on public safety, one on should we have an empty house tax. To me, those are, you know, legitimate, randomized, professional surveys. You guys are out there doing your own personal surveys
with your own biases.
Let me jump in. We've got to end this topic.
You've done a next door survey. You did it for redistricting and several other things.
All right. Let's. I can see that I, in planning this evening out, I should have had an evening for each of these topics, because each of these topics is significant enough that I feel the three of you could talk for 2 hours about them.
Absolutely.
These are not 1 minute topics or 10 minute topics. But speaking of long term, let's go to the next larger topic. And unfortunately, we only have about 6 minutes for this one, but let's get into it because it's important. Mm-hmm. The environment. Okay, as a coastal city, Half Moon Bay enjoys a very beautiful and sensitive environment. How well do you feel the city is doing on local environmental issues? What is your opinion about the city's climate action and adaptation plan? And do you feel that global climate change and sea level rise are issues that the city of Half Moon Bay should address? Anybody can take that one.
Well, yes, of course they should. It's a big problem. Everybody's worried about it. My concern with the city's approach with mandates is it treats all of the sources of CO2 emissions equally from an electrification of a home point of view. And yet we know that the bang per buck is much higher for some sources than for other sources. Just for example, most people that have a 10-year or older water heater could immediately replace that with a heat pump water heater and save money right out the gate, right now. Forget about the CO2 emissions. You're going to save money. It also reduces a lot of CO2 emissions, and it's hard for people to organize themselves to get a project going, particularly lower-income or middle-income folks. The city ought to be putting its energy into those. In my feeling estimation, we could get 1,000, maybe even 1,500 water heaters replaced in very short order. That would make a significant dent in the electrification bundle. Instead, we have a big debate over cooktops, which is minuscule.
Yep. Okay, so I'm going to jump in here because technically this was my turn and it was given away. So first I'm going to compliment Debbie. You led the charge on the electrification ordinance, and I was really proud of you because I thought what staff was doing was brilliant. And then you bailed on it after voting on the first reading, and then in the second reading you bailed on it, and then it became a handout to Rocket Farms, basically codifying that they could continue to burn gas until 2045. So where I want to go with this is very simple. I think the ordinance that the city came up with and that you were championing was very restrictive and obviously raised the ire of many people, and that was was difficult. I think it needed to be better messaged, or it needed to be more complex and more phased, so that there was less of a pushback, because it was just too abrupt. But I was also proud of you because I thought you're doing what you need to do. People, you know, I wrote this in big letters right now when Bill said right now. People want everything right now. They don't want to think about the future. I want it now. We need to think about. Sorry, I'm not supposed to pound on the table. We need to think about the future.
You're supposed to use a shoe.
I'm wearing boots. We need to think about the future for our kids, our grandkids, and we need to stop thinking about things in terms of the immediate, what do I get from this, what do I get right now. And so what I would do if I'm elected is to revisit the ordinance that you were championing, try to find ways to phase it in a more cost bearable way. That's not a word, but a more cost adaptable way. That's not a word either. Anyway, to make it more palatable and also to communicate to the public the benefits, because there was a lot of, I had my neighbors yelling to each other across the street stuff that was just blatantly false. And I would go out and talk to them and say, what are you talking about? And it's like, no. You don't know. I mean, I didn't say it this way, but you don't know what you're talking about, because they didn't. They were getting what they heard from someone else.
Uh-huh.
So we're on short time, so I'll turn it to you.
So where the city ended up was we approved electrification for all new construction. And initially we had a conversation about what they call burnout. In other words, if your gas appliance is at the end of its useful life, rather than replacing it with another gas appliance, you replace it with an electric appliance. And we heard from the public very strongly and from many public members that this was, you know, too much too soon. And I also looked around at what was available in terms of these appliances, the capacity to actually sell them and install them, and we're not where we need to be. I needed to replace my hot water heater, my electrical resistance hot water heater. I wanted a heat pump, and I couldn't get anybody to sell me one or come over here and install one. They said, we're not in Half Moon Bay yet, maybe in a couple of years. So it seemed to me that, you know, that we're not organized enough here in California to be able to actually sell install and maintain them. We need to, you know, teach workers and, you know,
which is why you would, all this you would sort of thing. Phase yeah. you would phase it differently, not junk the whole ordinance.
So that's junk the whole ordinance.
Not you,
we
the
approved
council
it for
did,
no, we didn't. We approved it for all new construction. So
but when we're talking about the environment, we need to talk also about throwing 1 million gallons into the ocean and not taking care of that when we could have a decade or more ago. That is also a sustainability issue.
Well, that's
one area where we could be 100% sustainable, recycling every bit of toilet waste and other waste out of your sewer system, both in terms of the solid portion and the water portion.
Everybody agrees on water recycling, but back to electrification. So it was my feeling that by moving too quickly, you get a backlash, and that sets us back. I think the right approach is to educate people, not only about the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, but the problems for health that you get from methane.
Yeah.
We now know that these things are not just harmful when they're being used, they're harmful just sitting in your house. So a lot of people did not understand the science or why we were moving forward like this.
EPA has looked at the exact same references you guys quoted and 1,000 more and has not developed an indoor NOx standard for a very simple reason. When they measure outdoor NOx, it's higher than indoor NOx.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's our bell. That's the end of this topic. All right, and we're back with the great debate. I am Reuben Truthmaker, the moderator for this event, and with me tonight are the three candidates for District 4 Half Moon Bay City Council. They are Debbie Ruddock, David Oblovy, and Bill Balson. They're here with me right now. I've been listening as you have, but they've been discussing a variety of topics important to voters in the city of Half Moon Bay and obviously District 4. Okay, these have been larger, meatier topics that have precipitated a lot of conversation and discussion, more so than we even had time for. So now we're gonna pull the rug right out from under these candidates right now. We're going to go to what I call the speed round. These are yes, no, either, or questions. And the reason I say that this is going to pull the rug out from under these three folks is because they are either politicians or aspiring politicians. And we are asking for a yes, no, or either or being, we'll give you, you know, either this or that. And so I know there's lots of extenuating circumstances and there's lots of factors to consider, but have a little fun with it. This is at a larger level, yes, no, either or. Okay, are we ready?
And well, can we do maybe so, too?
No. See, that's okay. Right. Okay, like, yeah, checking. Just, you know.
I think we just learned who the politician is.
Okay, so I'll go around. I'll start with Bill on this one, and we'll just ask all three of you.
Okay,
Bill, roundabouts or traffic lights?
Roundabouts.
David?
Both.
I don't know if we can allow that.
Some are appropriate in some places, others are appropriate in other places. That's my answer.
Okay, that's the answer you want to give? Okay.
Roundabouts.
Okay.
Except where we have signals in process. Roundabouts.
This is like it's a tricky format, right? Okay. All right. We'll start with David on this one. The Skyway Tram gondola system, are you interested in it or not?
Yes.
So I'm the one who brought this up at the 2014 debate, League of Women Voters debate in Half Moon Bay when I ran.
Yes,
so
no,
I'm going to go with yes. I'm just thinking out loud. I'm working through it in my head.
Okay.
And I'm going to go with yes because my view hasn't changed.
And
yes, and I not only had the idea separately and independently, I'm actually working to make it happen.
And Bill?
No, it displaces too much money from worthy projects.
Okay. All right. Next question. We'll start with Debbie on this one. Remove the outer seawall at Pillar Point Harbor, yes or no?
No.
Okay. Bill?
Absolutely no, and one shoreline should get out of the business.
And David?
I don't know enough about what's on the table to have an opinion.
Okay. All right. Nobody said they'd be easy. And we'll go back to Bill on this one. Consolidate the Mid-Coast with Half Moon Bay, yes or no?
No.
David?
Yes.
Debbie?
Yes.
Okay, this one, all right.
As long as you're not part of the Mid-Coast anymore.
I don't even live in this state. What are you talking about? They flew me in for this thing. David, starting with you, will you represent the people of District 4 or the people of Half Moon Bay?
Just my wife. She made me promise.
So that would be District 4, you're saying?
No, that District would be 4, everybody in Half Moon Bay.
All of Half Moon Bay. Okay, Debbie?
I've been representing all of Half Moon Bay for decades, so yes, Half Moon Bay.
Mm-hmm. Bill?
All of Half Moon Bay.
Okay. All right, next question. We'll start with, I think, David on this one. Are political endorsements important to voters or not?
No.
Debbie?
Yes.
Bill?
Not people over the hill. Endorsements from people in my district, yes, those are important.
They're important to voters here in the district.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Debbie, start with you. A community pool or a public performing arts center?
That's an either or.
Yep. Yep. These are yes, no, either ors.
A public performing arts center would be cheaper. A pool that's being envisioned by many in the community would be on the order of $40 to $50 million.
So which one? Which
art
one?
Center.
Art center.
For now.
Okay.
Bill?
The pool.
Pool? David?
We already have a performing arts center under construction, so I'm going to go with the pool.
Alrighty. A performing arts center under construction, where is that?
Carter Park.
Okay.
Hey, if you don't ask a specific enough question,
okay.
I can't
all
help
right.
you.
That's an outdoor venue, but...
you didn't right. say an indoor performing arts
okay.
center.
Okay, back to Bill on this one. Cannabis businesses within the city limits, are you in favor of that or no?
As long as youth are protected. I think adults should be allowed to, but youth have to be protected, and that's been my objection in the past.
Okay, David?
Yes.
Debbie?
The voters said no. I'd be happy to have a new ballot, and if they say yes, yes. But the voters have already said no.
What is your personal feeling on it?
My personal feeling is that adults should be able to access local retail. I know from talking to distributors who bring in trucks and deliver it to people's homes that there are more than 1,000 customers between the tunnel and Pescadero. So, you know, it's just, you know, people are using it, but they don't want to see a, you know, retail in their community or expose it to children. And I get that. But, you know, other communities are taking advantage of the revenue. I think if you can do it well with lots of security, it makes sense. But I told the voters, I would not trump their decision, and I stand by it.
I asked a follow-up. That was why, David.
Yeah. Oh.
Okay, related question, and we'll let's see. This one, I think, is to Debbie this time.
Mm-hmm.
Should sales of flavored tobacco be legal within the Half Moon Bay city limits?
No, and we've already said no to that. Yeah.
Bill?
Yes, it should.
David?
No.
Okay. Okay. You've got one of three choices on this one. Growth on the coast side, and I say the coast side because we're all interrelated here, but let's talk just city of Half Moon Bay. Growth on the coast side, pro, slow, or no?
Slow.
Bill?
Slow. We're in a housing crisis.
David?
Do I get 2 minutes to editorialize like she did last
question? Only if
I
need to ask a follow-up question.
So I'm also going to refuse to answer this question purely because it's oversimplifying a complex topic, and
exactly.
I refuse to.
Well, all these questions.
Exactly that you.
Well, no, I flavored tobacco. I'm good. But this one, I support. A good example. I support Greg Jameson's project at the end of Half Moon Bay or Half Moon
you
Bay.
You mean the Hyatt Place Hotel?
Place, yeah.
You support
Whereas,
the Hyatt Place Hotel?
Yeah. Absolutely. I have since he brought it to the Planning Commission. The Dunes Beach would be a disaster, right? So these are nuanced questions that can't be answered with a yes or no or slow or whatever. So.
Well, okay. All right. Next one back to Bill. Off-leash dog walking in designated areas. Are you for or against such a thing?
I'm for it.
David?
I almost killed myself trying not to hit a dog on my mountain bike yesterday. And literally ended up on my so I would be for it, but I can't figure out how to make it not supremely annoying for those of us who aren't walking our dogs off
in designated areas.
Oh, in designated areas, sure,
yes.
Go for it.
Okay,
designated areas, absolutely.
Yep. Okay. Parking meters for downtown, yes or no? David?
No.
Debbie?
No.
Bill?
No.
Okay. Let's see. And this, I'm going to come back to a question that I asked earlier. Not sure why I'm doing that, but I'm doing it, so here we go. Would you be in favor of constructing an overnight homeless shelter, just one night, you know, one night occupant or one night stay, an overnight homeless shelter for the coastside? Yes or no, Debbie?
I'm in favor of a safe parking program, but there's plenty of shelter space over the hill, so I would say no.
Okay. Bill?
No, there's plenty of space.
David?
I'm going to take a brief editorial here just because I actually didn't get to comment on this, that the thing ended. But basically, I'm in agreement with Debbie that a safe parking area would be desirable, and we don't have a demand. We don't need – it would be a waste of resources to spend funds on that. So my answer would be no.
Okay. All right. Now, we're going to go back to our discussion topics. We've got a little extra time. I really appreciate you playing along with that session right there. I know it's hard. As you all three mentioned, those were not necessarily yes-no questions, but I really appreciate you playing along with that. So let's go back to a larger topic, and public safety and policing. The city of Half Moon Bay no longer has its own police force, instead contracting with county for law enforcement services from the county sheriff's department. Do you feel that this is the best arrangement for the safety and well-being of Half Moon Bay residences, residents? And what concerns do you have if you don't feel that it's enough? How can the sheriff's department improve its service to Half Moon Bay? And what other ideas do you have for policing and public safety in Half Moon Bay? Again, these are just kind of a scattershot of things that, to launch you off. And let's start with David on that one.
Good, because I was going to jump up and start waving if I didn't get picked first. So as most people are aware, I was involved with council members Jimenez and Rarbeck last year with the Jimenez-Rarbeck report, or the initiative basically is what came out of it, which seeks to revisit how we police and provide public safety in the city of Half Moon Bay. So let me say up front, I am not in favor, nor would I move to change or alter our service agreement with the sheriff's office in terms of them providing us with services. What I am in favor of, profoundly, is in revisiting how we use those resources, how we provide oversight for those resources, and how we work with the sheriff's office. And instead of, as was the case with the Sandra Harmon shooting, having them dictate to us pretty much everything and not pursuing it, that we would appoint a chief of police, which can be done in a revenue-neutral way. One of the ways it would be revenue-neutral is by taking one of the assigned officers. We pay $350,000 for each assigned officer that patrols Half Moon Bay, or full-time equivalent. We pay $350,000 for them to issue traffic tickets, for example. That can be done and is being done in other cities by community service officers who net out at about $85,000 a year. So we need to look and rethink how we approach policing for the purposes of providing policing that does minimal harm on our community, which is something most people don't think about. The thing they always think about is, did you stop crime? Did you get the bad guy? You know, someone got shot. Well, that's too bad. We need to look at the what's called iatrogenic harm, which is when a Latino man gets stopped for a broken taillight and loses his car as a result because he's driving on a suspended license, which is not a moving violation, by the way, and the family can't get to work or go to school anymore. Is that harm? The question we have to ask ourselves is that harm justify what we did in the first place to cause it? This is a discussion we haven't had in Half Moon Bay. We were hoping to have, and unfortunately it was shut down. So what I'm proposing is we open our minds and we think a little bit. I'm not proposing to defund the police in any way. In fact, I'd be in favor of increasing funding if we need to make programs and services work. Our work led to the adoption of the CARES program. It's a halfway to where we want to go. But this is a critical item for Half Moon Bay that is within our reach if we want to we want to go after it. And frankly, it's the biggest single difference between Debbie and me and Bill and me in terms of what our approaches would be in Half Moon Bay. So I'll now turn it over to my
Let's hear
colleagues.
About some of those different approaches, Debbie or Bill.
Well, first of all, you know, I may have endorsed Sheriff Bolanos at one time, but when I found out about what was going on with him, I withdrew publicly my nomination for him. I just wanted to clear the air on that one. So the city signed a contract with the sheriff's office in 2011, one of the best decisions we ever made. It saves us, we figure, $2 to $4 million a year. And you know, we can use that savings to do things like, you know, fund our community services grant program. We can, you know, help support the CARES program until it's, you know, pretty much on a sustainable basis. We can provide more, you know, parks and recreation, you know, so sort of attack the causes of crime, if you will, as opposed to just spending money on policing people, right? So I think it's a really good decision. We get a lot of services for it, a lot of, you know, task force work and involvement with youth, which we wouldn't get, you know, ordinarily. So I agree there are issues of transparency and accountability. I was one of the first people to support this idea of the Citizens Oversight Commission because I think we need a system of checks and balances. I don't think the sheriff system is bad. Yes, we've had a problem with the sheriff, but we have a new sheriff coming on that I think we can work with. The city is very limited in its ability to do pretextual stops because the CHP and the sheriff's office control highways 92 and 1. You know, we might be able to work with them on that, but we're limited. Now, the Public Policy Institute of California just came out with a study that, yes, pretextual stops are still a problem. Especially for black men. It remains about proportional for the Latino population and white population, but way out of whack for African Americans. And it recommended two things. Traffic cameras, highway cameras, and then handling citations, you know, by mail so that you're not having interactions between. Let me just finish. So we brought up the issue of traffic cameras a couple years ago, had a robust conversation with the public, and they didn't want it for privacy reasons. And some didn't want it also for equity reasons because of this issue of traffic stops and the most vulnerable people getting stopped, you know, more frequently. But, you know, given the sort of increase in petty crimes and things, one thing we could do is revisit the conversation about traffic cameras and see if people's, you know, opinions have changed about that. But I think we should also support maybe the idea of citations by mail.
Let me get a word.
Running out of time, but I want to give Bill a chance to say something.
We should support the new sheriff in her job. She needs to get her feet wet, make some recommendations. There's post-training. People ought to go online and look at these things. They're very detailed training for the deputies. She can make changes to the post-training. We can make recommendations to her as to what to do. She's already said she's going to form a citizen advisory group of her own. We ought to just give her a chance.
Okay, so thank you, Bill, and Debbie, and also David. Thank you for those major discussion points. At this point, we're running out of time. We only have 10 minutes left. 2 hours has flown by. Mm-hmm. So what we'd like to do now is kick it back to each of you for a brief 1 to 2 minute closing statement, kind of, you know, your summary statement. And let's see, I think we began with Bill, so let's start with Debbie on this one, on the closing statements.
Yeah, I feel I have to address the issue of the Main Street Bridge. So, yes, the initiative to protect the Main Street Bridge from replacement was a good idea. You know, represented, you know, good intentions. But, and David, you know, was a leader on that idea and getting the initiative written. But when the time came to do the actual work, you know, on what would shore up rather than replace the bridge, David's judgment failed himself and us. He did get on the Main Street Bridge Advisory Committee. One would expect that as the principal author of the initiative that he would have exercised leadership on, you know, coming up with an appropriate solution that was compliant with the initiative. But no. It took 7 years. He was on the advisory committee. He was off the advisory committee. He did a lot of complaining. People felt he was obstructing things. And then an election year before he wants to run, he threatens the city with a lawsuit, you know, if we didn't just stop all work in the bridge? Why couldn't that have happened on year one or year two? And now, you know, he's threatening to sue us. So he's not saving us money. He's threatening to cost us money. So I'd like to say that, you know, people with good intentions, you know, can screw up. And what you really want are people with, you know, experience and good judgment. And I would contrast David with myself in that. You know, I was a co-author of two citizen initiatives to manage growth. And not only were they successful, but I ran for city council to make sure they were implemented. And I worked with the Coastal Commission and city staff to make sure they represented the voters' will. And I've worked since then to improve the implementation on them. So, you know, you have somebody with good intentions and bad judgment, and then I think I have experience and good judgment, and that I've exercised that. And I'm sorry, David, but the Main Street Bridge was a fiasco.
Okay, thank you, Debbie. David, let's hear your closing remarks.
So the reason I didn't write a cease and desist letter to the city before January 2nd this year is because I didn't know about it. I sent my first PRA request in October. I was on the Main Street Bridge Committee for about 3 months. We made a recommendation to the city council that you spend $50,000 to do a study. You shot it down, and I said, this is a waste of time because the council's not going to listen to us. I've got better things to do, which I did. The project that you stopped, you voted unanimously in closed session to halt the project, not because I was threatening to sue the city. I was threatening to sue the city because the project violated the Main Street Bridge Preservation Act. You were going to put a 170-foot-long slab 6 inches above what the remains of the bridge that you had torn down. That had nothing to do with me, Debbie. That was not me. And the reason I acted was because it didn't comply with the Main Street Bridge Preservation Act. If I'd known about it earlier, trust me, I would have stopped it earlier because it was non-compliant from basically 2019 on. So going back to who we are as candidates, I think this sums up the difference between us perfectly. You are entrenched in the system. You are a consummately capable politician who can move levers in ways that are profound. You're also colorblind or light blind to things that, just like the Sam issue, where even after we were off the air, we were arguing about whether or what the city should do. You're too close to it. So the difference between us is, if you want the same thing that the city's been doing for X amount of time, you should vote for Debbie, and I would be proud to consider you still a friend if you get reelected. If you want someone who's going to come in with a new look, a new attitude, not a new look, no one wants my look, a new attitude and a new approach, then you should vote for me. And you should go to my website, which is davidforhmb.com. You can find my cease and desist letter that I wrote to the city. It's 8 pages, I believe, with expressive documentation about the problems with that project. And the city killed it in 6 weeks, which should tell you all you need to know about that letter. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, David. All right, Bill, let's hear from you.
So I mentioned in my introduction that I have a 5-point plan for Half Moon Bay. It's designed to get Half Moon Bay back on track. The city did a survey back in the summer showing that a very large percentage of the town believes that Half Moon Bay is not on track. The first point is to start a collaborative study with Caltrans of options to reduce congestion, including Route 1 and Route 92. The second point is to start a study to permanently modify encampments to prevent new campers and to review spending plans for cost effectiveness. Number three, to begin a thorough investigation of sewer fund mismanagement and get water recycling back on track. Number four, begin a top-to-bottom financial review to restore fiscal discipline and create a 30-year financial plan, just like HOAs are required to do. Number five, begin a comprehensive review of ordinances to reduce mandates on small businesses and get rid of the ineffective ones. My website again is www.BillDawson2022.com, and there's a Spanish language version at the same site.
All right. Thank you, Bill. That concludes the great debate, and I just want to offer a few comments about our candidates here. Listeners, thank you for listening. I hope everybody plans on voting. And what I want to say as a potential voter, as a person out in the voting community, is I really respect these three people for offering themselves up to public service. It takes a lot of courage to stand in front of people, to express your ideas when you know that some people will agree and some people will not agree.
Yeah.
It also takes a lot of courage to come and sit on live radio for 2 hours in an unscripted setting. I mean, it really, like, as a person who is on radio, I can really tell you that for these people to come here really says something about their character, and I'm glad that the people of this community were able to hear the three of you in this unscripted setting. Hopefully they got to know you a little bit better, know your positions a little bit better, and that gives them some confidence when they go to the ballot box. I'd also like to thank our engineer for tonight, Frank the engineer, doing an awesome job over at the control booth.
Yay, Frank.
Right? And radio legend Jay Michaels, who is also helping out in our remote location. So we are coming to you today from the beating heart of District 4, which was another important thing about this event, because we wanted to have it with the candidates in their district. And that's one of the things that makes this a historic event. It's on live radio. It's 2 hours. It's the three candidates in their home district. So thank you to radio station KYMM, our sister station, for putting this on. If anybody's wondering where Jim Henderson was tonight, I'm sorry to say that Jim is a little bit under the weather, and so he felt that in a close setting like this, in a studio where we're all sitting on top of each other, maybe not the best thing. I think we all appreciate that, and we wish best for Jim and hope that he gets well soon. So, the election is coming up in a couple weeks. If you haven't already voted, please please get yourself to a polling station, submit your vote, or go there, as I do, on election day. I'm an old school person. I think I've mentioned this story a few times. Like, growing up, I lived out in the middle of nowhere. We would literally get in a car and drive, like, 6 miles up a windy road to an old farmhouse that was probably built in, like, the 1880s or something. And everybody in the community would come there and vote. And I can remember, as a child, going there when I was, like, 6 or 7, potbelly stove burning, it's cold outside, we go in, it's hot inside, that heat that you get from a potbelly stove, and everybody in the community is there standing around talking to each other. It has influenced my feeling about the primacy of voting in our country.
Absolutely.
Great memories of it, and also, like, how important it was to, that really influenced me as a child, how important it was for these adults. And I can see that in the faces of the three candidates here today. And again, I just really thank you for stepping forward tonight and on election day.
Well, thank you for your hospitality.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Okay, so
I'm still not letting your kid pitch.
Yeah, I think he's timed out of any coaching that you might do, David.
I saw him behind City Hall at the pancake breakfast, and he's 6'10"?
Yeah, he's getting there. While we've got here's one more question I'll ask you, since we've got just a couple more seconds here, and this is a quick hitter, right? Start with Debbie. What's your favorite thing about Pumpkin Festival, since we just had that and David just mentioned the pancake breakfast?
The color orange.
Oh, that's one of my favorite colors as well. I love when people paint their front door orange. I love that. David, how about you? Pumpkin Festival, favorite thing about it?
This is the wrong answer, but we have a shop on Main Street, and it's our biggest revenue weekend by leaps and bounds. It's vital to our sustenance.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. That's an important part of it, because not only for merchants on Main Street, but also lots of nonprofits.
The nonprofits, the overall economic benefit of that is that whole event is astonishing. Yep. Money that flows through this town.
It's a beautiful thing.
So my favorite part,
what about you, Bill?
Is taking my granddaughters to see the greatest pumpkin ever. The biggest.
The giant pumpkin, right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
The great pumpkin. Come on.
Well, I really appreciate everybody. I'm Ruben Truthmaker. I've been lucky enough to be the moderator of this event tonight, and I really appreciate our three candidates, Debbie Ruddick, David Oblovy, and Bill Balson, for being here tonight. Please go out and vote. And hey, vote for one of these three if you live in District 4. All right. Thank you very much. This has been The Great Debate on KHMB.